With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of the Cult Option Podcast was brought to you by our Patreon. If you want to tell us which films we should watch, listen to up to two extra exclusive podcasts a month, or give us something to discuss in our new post-credit scenes at the end of each episode, then please consider joining the cult and donating at www.patreon.com/cultpopshire. Hey everybody, it's AJ. Just at the start of this episode, the most disappointing films of 2019, part 3. This is where we cover the second half of the year, and this episode will be split into two parts. We don't know when that will be when recording, so this is just me at the start saying, hey, this episode's two parts. And I will come in again at the end to remind you of all the wonderful ways you can interact and support Cult Popshire. Just to let you know, there are time codes in the show notes below of what we talk about and when we talk about. So if you want to avoid spoilers, they are there for you now. Thanks, everybody. Let's get on with the show. Come along, everybody, to Cult Popshire Podcast Season 5.
Thank you for having me.
Happy New Year, Richard.
Happy New Year, Alex.
Happy New Year, Jeremy.
Happy New Year, Alexander. And Happy New Year, Richard.
Oh. You're going to say Happy
Richard's
New Year to Jeremy,
fine,
Richard?
So he can't be bothered responding to me.
Did I have a good New Year? Was that what you asked?
No, I didn't.
Get off your phone. Look up,
yeah,
man. There's
but
a whole world.
Good content that I wasn't listening.
There's a whole world out there, man.
So what's this is we thought we would celebrate ringing in the new decade,
which is
by
a new
backtracking.
Decade.
Yeah, it is a new decade. Despite what certain blackboards outside cafes will tell you, this is a new decade. In fact, tomorrow can be a new decade, depending on where you'd start at the time.
But there is a significance to the fact that the tens column in the year has changed to a 2.
Yes.
Anyway.
Even if it's just cultural significance.
Yeah, anyway, what are we doing
real,
today?
Real applicable to the task at hand.
Yeah, so at the midway through last year, we did our most disappointing films of 2019 so far, knowing that these podcasts literally, not even exaggerating, get longer with each year we do them.
Yeah,
we just take every year as an encouragement for the next one.
They double every year. Have you noticed that? They actually double in size every year because our first half of the year was like 2.5 hours or so we split it into two episodes of part 3 and 4. We will probably be doing the same with this episode unless by some miracle we're only here for
We've just stopped
two
having
hours.
Anything to say about movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that came
so
out.
This is,
cool, good.
Yeah, I don't have any opinions about that.
So yeah, this is the most disappointing films of 2019, part 3 of 4, possibly. And there will be time codes in the description of this episode and the show notes for the certain movies when we talk about them, because we're not necessarily going to be spoiling everything.
Oh, no, we are.
We're definitely,
it's my personal goal to spoil every movie on this.
Okay,
so just
I was going to clarify, like, we might only have a few things to say about Hobbs and Shaw, and then we'll move on. But other movies will be like, so here's what happens in the end. So
yeah,
all right, spoiling every movie.
Yeah, so
just skip
the way this
it.
Works is this is kind of a sequel to our most anticipated films of 2019. So I've still got the list of all the films we went through there, so if you remember what we said about these a year ago and you're waiting to hear the follow-up,
just can't wait to hear it.
So we'll run through those, the ones we talked about previously, and then there's other films that have come out that we maybe didn't know that were coming out this time last year. So the last film, I believe, we ended talking about was Ford v Ferrari, which ended up being bumped till November. It didn't even come out in the first half of the year. And then none of us saw it. So
there's a few of these that we said we'd see and none of us did, even in part.
Yeah, actually, two, I was going to say that AJ, it was your big idea to go watch Hellboy and Men in Black International. So if you could just give us your summation of those films, because being a man of your word, I'm sure you've done that.
Listen, I've never claimed to be a man of my word.
Listen, I never listen.
Because, okay, those movies received nothing but negative reviews. Yeah. And so I was like, what is my hot take going to be on these universally panned movies? I don't need to see them. They're apparently very bad. And maybe that's the review. That's the cult pop show review. So bad I didn't bother.
Yeah. I'm happy with it. oh, good. Okay, so we talked about an untitled Annabelle film, part of the like Conjuring universe. Did this come out? I don't know what it was called.
It was called Annabelle Comes Home.
Is that, or is it come out next year or something? I don't know.
No, that came out this year.
Oh,
that came out
Annabelle
same day
film?
As Toy Story. Remember, because Toy Story 4, Chucky, and Annabelle Comes Home all came out the same time. That's and right. They're all about talking live toys.
Yeah. Okay, but the first sort of big release that we saw after the mid-year break was Spider-Man Far From Home. So this was on my most anticipated of the year. And you know what? It was pretty good.
It was pretty good.
Who saw it?
I have some. Well, Jeremy, what did you think of
was
Spider-Man
Was it pretty
Far
good,
From
though?
Home?
Or was it really disappointing? Because for me, it was really disappointing.
Really, I'd either go pretty good or really good.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was fantastic.
I love that, like, me coming in and casting just a shade of doubt makes you go, oh, fuck, I'm
no,
scared.
I mean, like,
yeah,
it genuinely
awesome.
Was great. I saw it
he
a couple
like
of times.
He looks like a gorilla sparring up to defend his young.
I was comedically underselling it.
Oh, good. Okay. That's nice. Well, let me comedically undersell my not liking of this movie.
Okay.
It was fine. No, the thing I think that this movie was really, really good, except for the character of Jake Gyllenhaal's character and the sort of the evil plot part of it. Because I felt like just the use of tech and the projections and everything was such a... it was full of so many holes in terms of how you'd actually accomplish those things that for me it took me completely out of the movie and I couldn't really enjoy any of it. Or even though I enjoyed all the performances of all the people who'd been in the movies before, and I thought that like all the stuff between Spider-Man and Mary Jane and that was awesome. I really enjoyed it. I loved the travel. I loved the locations. I just really didn't believe the big bad. All and right. So that
well,
kind
can
of
can you list one of these some of these plot holes? That ruined the movie for
Man, it's been so long since I've seen the movie, but
I just remember I thought there were plot holes in it.
He would have had to they had to record everything that they wanted the drones to project before the attack happened, which meant that they would have had to anticipate every single thing that Spider-Man did so that they could get the drones to react to those things to project what needed to happen. And you can't do that. Like, you absolutely can't do that. And so, and they didn't have anyone doing it live. And so it was
I don't think they necessarily don't have anyone doing it live.
Well, they didn't. No, they pre-recorded all of the stuff. And so you can't do a 3D.
Is it pre-recorded or is it like
you can't
dynamically
do a 3D projection of a reality that you don't know what that reality is supposed to do? Like, in order to project, it actually has to... Yeah, anyway. I found the use of tech really, really, like, flawed.
This kind of thing is what I've come to refer to in recent years as a Jeremy problem, where it's, like, a problem with the nitpicky, like, world building of the film. And it just doesn't bother me as much because I'm like, yeah, obviously this is impossible, but so is Spider-Man. Spider-Man
no,
is impossible.
I want films to be internally consistent in terms of, like... I will totally get on board with the fact that they have the ability to create these drones that project things so that people see a normal reality. But the way that they create those reality, like, it just, I don't know. And also, AJ, you've totally come on board with me for a few of these. So I'm going to reject your overall criticism of Jeremy-isms because you're totally on board for some of them.
Dude, the worst, I hate to dredge up old shit, but I think every day about how much you said you liked About Time when I think that's got the most Jeremy problems I've ever seen in a movie.
Well, that's the thing. Maybe like that's just evidence to say that if a movie is good enough in other aspects, it can overwhelm the Jeremy-isms, but this one wasn't for me.
I thought that I really liked Mysterio, Jake Gyllenhaal's character. Same. I really liked kind of the double plays this movie did.
I liked the way the drones like kind of were live reacting to what happened.
At any point,
I specifically liked the thing Jeremy didn't like.
No, but at any point, did you ever think that Jake Gyllenhaal wasn't a bad guy?
No, but he's a bad guy in the comics, so anyone with like half a brain knows he's going to.
So what's the point of doing a double play?
No, well, they did that really well because the first trailer was like so obvious. It's like, yeah, you're doing one of Spider-Man's classic rogue part of his rogues gallery. But they left the reveal so long in the movie that you're like, are they really doing it? And then it's like, no, of course not. And so I thought that was because everyone knew going into that film that he was going to be revealed to be the villain. But the way they did it, I thought, was like as good as they could have done it, that it's still a reveal.
I did really enjoy his speech in the bar. That was really
Yeah, that was great.
Great.
And it was so like, it was like lampshade hanging of like,
oh, totally.
This is ridiculous.
He was chewing the scenery.
AJ, was it you that said you had an issue up to that point about like the elementals and stuff?
Yeah, like all the elementals are like, you know, the first story you write when you're 10 years old has elementals in it. Like it's such a basic building block of fantasy storytelling that I was like, they're really doing elementals as the villain in the, 24th, 23rd MCU film? That's so basic. And then I was also like, why? Like, it's so crazy that Spider-Man would go to Europe and his problems like are there as well. That's so coincidental. And it turns out the reason it's coincidental is because it's being specifically orchestrated by Mysterio to lure in Spider-Man.
And so I thought the cheap sci-fi is written by a shitty sci-fi writer.
Yeah. So I thought that was a really interesting way of doing that. I liked a lot of it, and I liked a lot of the movies. One thing I don't really like is the fact that that Samuel Jackson was Talos the whole time. He was Talos shapeshifted as Nick Fury. I don't think it added anything to the story. The only thing I like about it is that they're keeping Talos in the background cast because I really like Ben Mendelsohn and I'd like to see that character show up again. But I don't think it added anything. And if anything, I feel like it detracted from Samuel Jackson's portrayal as Nick Fury in the movie. Mm. Except for where it's obviously being signposted that it's not actually him. You can't talk about Spider-Man Far From Home without talking about the fact that J.K. Simmons shows up in the post-credit scene as J. Jonah Jameson.
How good
you know
was
I
that?
Cheered in the theater.
Jeremy,
I thought that was
did
awesome.
You like that?
I did not stay for long
what?
Enough to see it.
You do like it's literally like the they have like four or five names come up, and then maybe like 30 seconds pass.
What happens in this post-credit sequence? Because
so
I may have seen
the
it.
Film
like
ends,
the most important
the film
thing
ends
in
with
the movie.
Him taking Zendaya around New York, and then he's like, oh, I've got to go, and then it goes to credits, and then 20, 30 seconds pass, and then it comes back, and it's like, we've now got a special news report on this big billboard from controversial news website, The Daily Bugle, and then it's J. Jonah Jameson, played by J.K. Simmons, who's like, the mass known as Spider-Man. And it's like, so essentially Quentin Beck recorded a little video that made Spider-Man look responsible for all of his crimes, and then he's like, and one more thing, Spider-Man is Peter Parker, and then Peter Parker's face is blasted.
So that was really cool, and I like how for years they're contemplating of who do you get to recast as J. Jonah Jameson when J.K. Simmons was so perfect. And it's such an obvious choice now that it's happened to just be like, continuity, canons be damned, we're casting the same guy.
Yeah, but also it's like a completely different interpretation of the character in some ways. Like,
absolutely.
It's an updated version of the media mogul for 2019.
Well, it's like how they used the footage of Marlon Brando for Spider-Man's for Kal-El, no, Jor-El, in Superman Begins.
Returns. So, well, Brando Ralph.
Yeah. Superman Returns. Yeah. It's like, yeah, we've changed everyone else, but we'll still have Marlon Brando.
Yeah,
but I think Superman Returns is technically a sequel.
Yeah, that's trying
Superman
to be
movie.
A follow-on from the Christopher Reeve 1 and 2.
This is just someone playing the same character over two different universe canons.
But they recast every other character, including Lex Luthor, who appeared in
It's still supposed to be a sequel, and you're supposed to ignore the recasting.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's still technically the same universe.
Right, okay.
It's like, the same way that, Val Kilmer's Batman is supposed to be the next adventure of Michael Keaton's.
So the my biggest problem with Spider-Man Far From Home is that is when it came out. It came out too close to Endgame. I think it should have come out around now. I don't know enough about what's when's good to release movies, but I think that 3 months after Endgame was not enough breathing room.
Yeah.
I think it's because it starts immediately like lampooning the snap by showing it on cell phone footage and seeing like shittily edited Tony Stark memorial videos, which I don't have a problem with them undercutting the joke, like undercutting the serious moment with a joke, but it almost felt like it feels like we needed Endgame to be the last thing we see for ages and then Spider-Man Far From Home to swing in and be like, hey, we're back, everybody, and now we're making jokes about everything.
Yeah.
I think it should have been the start of Phase 4, and I know there was a bunch of behind-the-scenes shit that would have made that complicated, and imagine if the whole shit about Sony and Marvel falling out had happened before Far From Home was released. That'd be so interesting.
Yeah.
But I do think that... And, you know, in 20 years when people are watching these movies, apart from their release dates, no one's going to care about this. But as someone watching them in real time, I felt like it came out too soon.
Mm. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it's the thing that it's like, it's in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. But, yeah, as an audience member.
Like many things.
And then also, like, having to wait almost a year for the next MCU film, and I want it now.
Oh, I want Black Widow now!
Okay, so up next, we talked about a film called Stuber, which is Kumail Nanjiani's Stu, Uber driver. It's an action movie. I watched this.
And neither AJ or I did either. Yeah. I mean, well, no. That didn't make any sense, but AJ and I didn't.
It's fine. It's like, it's exactly what you would expect it to be.
Yeah, you prevented me from watching this by giving me your like short summary of it. And I was like, cool, that sounds...
Yeah, it's like... I don't know. There's a few nice moments. Like, Kumail Nanjiani's funny.
Yeah.
Dave Bautista's a fun screen presence. They have good chemistry.
This is a thought I've had recently, like, seeing the trailer for his next movie coming up. I'm like, I'm really enjoying the rockification of Dave Bautista. Like, just the full kind of, like, no, we'll accept him as an actor across kind of any genre.
Yeah.
Like, he's actually just, and now he doesn't need to wear prosthetics or, like, dress up as anything. Mm. He just can be an actor in a movie.
Yeah.
And he's a good screen presence.
I would argue he's a better actor than Dwayne Johnson, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, Dwayne Johnson fills a specific role on screen, which is to be the biggest action superstar of our current time.
Other than Dave Bautista. Second only to Dave Bautista.
Yeah, I have a feeling Dave Bautista, meh, nah.
There was a while where I was just fan casting Dave Bautista and everything on this podcast. Because I was such a fan. He's so good in Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, in such a small role. And his little short that they did before.
His short film is excellent, yeah.
Mm. But yeah, I like that he's taking more interesting roles. Even his villain in Spectre was, you know, kind of mildly interesting compared to the rest of the film. Okay, next up is a big one, The Lion King. Now, this isn't your animated favorite classic from the early 90s.
Wait, but Richard, The Lion King came out in 1994. Yes.
Well, AJ, it was remade in 2019.
In live action?
With real lions. And real
king-looking lions.
The podcast is cancelled. It is still animated. How dare you? How dare you insinuate this is a live action film when it's 100% animated? You fucking...
It's actually not 100% animated. The first shot of the film is not animated.
Wow. And that defines a movie.
I can't believe a movie is
defined by the first shot.
If you were to tell me at the beginning of this year that by the end of the year I would just have no feelings or thoughts about The Lion King, like the remake of The Lion King.
I'm glad you kept talking. I was like, Jesus.
Like,
he had a child.
I just shut up. I just wouldn't have believed you, but I went to it and I just didn't care about any of it. I was just like, okay, all right, sure. You know, like it's just the only bit that made me at all riled up or excited about it, like, was when I got pissed off about that when Simba is running back to the Pride Lands and they have that really horrifically jammed in original Beyonce song, which is so inappropriate. It's like, Spirit, what the hell? It's just like, it was like... the way I described it to my wife at the time was that basically it's the final song on for an X Factor winner. And like the feel of it is like
it's very Leona Lewis.
All the sparks are coming down on the stage, and all the previous contestants are rushing onto the stage to congratulate someone. Yeah. And like, and there's the ticker tape comes out, and it meets the sparks, and there's like a hellish fire that like consumes them all. I mean, sorry, that's just what I want to happen. But like, I just was like, this is so wrong for this moment of like Simba returning to his like. Oh, just anyway.
I 100% know what you mean.
But that was the only part that made me feel anything. Other than Timon and Pumbaa, which was great.
Yeah, I thought Timon and Pumbaa were fun updates to the characters.
Timon and Pumbaa were a peek at what this whole movie could have been.
Exactly. Yeah. It was the only place where they trusted themselves to do something new, because they were like, you know what, if we just try to copy... And it's funny because they were like, if we copy comedy, it will fall flat. But they think that if they copy songs, they copy performance notes from like the actors' voice performances, that's totally fine and everyone wants a mimic. But there's something so ingrained in comedy where you can't steal people's jokes, because if you try to steal someone's joke and do it, it will just fall flat. And they knew it. And so they let the comedy happen for new, and it just showed what they should have done with the rest.
Yeah, and as far as I know, and it's rare for like voiceover films, but they had Donald Glover, Billy Eichner, and Seth Rogen in the room together improvising, because Donald Glover's a talented comedic actor as well. Like, he's done a lot of stand-up and stuff like that. But he's I thought the adult Simba and Nala were a lot worse than the kid ones.
Oh, Donald Glover and Beyonce suck in this movie.
Yeah.
I'm a big Donald Glover fan. I'm ambivalent about Beyonce. But like, when I watched this, I was like, you know what? Hot take out the gate. They are terrible in this.
Yeah. Terrible voice actors.
Can You Feel the Love Today?
No. Bright Sun the whole time they're singing it. And you've reminded me what else I said at the time, which was that basically Donald Glover and Beyonce's line readings, because that's what they were, sounded like when you get like the two popular kids in the English class to read like the main characters and when you're reading through a Shakespeare play, and like it's just like, oh, these kids are the most popular ones in the class, and then it turns out they just suck, but they got the roles because they were like the most popular ones and not the most talented ones.
The worst line readings were from James Earl Jones. He just sounds tired and old. and you look at behind the scenes footage of him, and you know, everyone like Billy Eichner, Timon, and all that are like, they're all having a lot of fun. And then he's sitting in a chair.
Is it like a Weekend at Bernie's?
He's got the script
scenario
in front of him, and he's just kind of just like saying the stuff. Like,
I'm doing this again 20 years later.
Yeah. I think
with Timon and Pumbaa being the highlight, they are like they represent what Aladdin could have been with Will Smith as the genie.
Yeah,
and how we talked about that, you cannot be doing these movies where you get known like celebrity personalities in and then not have them be those celebrity personalities in favor of you know, honoring the original source material. You shouldn't be making these movies at all, Disney. Like, that's the biggest takeaway, I think, at least in terms of quality. In terms of money, The Lion King's like one of the highest grossing animated films of all time now, I think. Like, the remake is technically animated, so it's highest grossing. I asked on the Cult Popshire Discord, which you can find a link to in the show notes to join, what people thought was the most disappointing movie of the year. Mm-hmm. One person said The Lion King, and then everyone just talked about The Lion King. so I guess that's
the answer.
Consensus.
Well, thanks for listening. We don't talk any more about the rest of the movies.
Because people were talking about how it's weird how Jon Favreau can do something. Jon Favreau's got such a yo-yo career, man, because he has done some incredible work with Marvel and even The Jungle Book, I would say, is easily the best live action Disney remake. But The Lion King is like, the problems with The Lion King are all the problems everyone thought The Lion King was going to have. And then he went and made The Mandalorian, which was, you know, at the best of times, praised.
I think it just shows that some knots are impossible to untangle. Like, you just, everyone knew that those are going to be the problems with The Lion King, and he was a really good choice to try and overcome them. And yet, I guarantee you that with the set of rules that were laid down for how you, the studio was willing for you to do this, and the priorities that they had for making that kind of movie, he just wasn't able to piece together a satisfying creation out of it.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating experiment. I don't think it in any way replaces the first one, which is the same as Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin. It's a fascinating testament to the power of the Kuleshov effect as well, that like it, your enjoyment of this movie depends on how much emotion you're willing to put on blank faces because of what you know they're supposed to be reacting to.
Yeah.
And so if you're able to buy into that, and it's like you shouldn't have to do this, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've, because a lot of people are like, this just looks creepy. The animals' faces don't move at all. But I was able to see a lot of, like, it was these very subdued, subtle performances, I felt. And because I don't know, I guess I just bought the film on those terms. And I quite liked it. I still had a good, I would say I had a good time at the movies, but this is one of the worst movie-going experiences I've had in my entire life.
Oh, yeah, I remember this.
I would shoot to like this because I think I went on like opening night or like opening weekend or whatever at this mall that I never go to the movies at. And it was like, I was just so crowded and like there were so many people there. People were like talking to their friends on the other side of the cinema right through the like trailers and like right up until the opening logos. People were walking in 15, 20 minutes into the film, people were taking flash photography of Mufasa's death.
Oh my God.
And like, spoilers for The Lion King. Yeah, it was like, while I enjoyed the movie, this is like one of the worst cinema going experiences in my entire life.
What I really hope is that this year the studios learn the right lessons from the failures of these movies. So I'd say like, basically this year is the year that studios should learn that hand-drawn animation and like, you know, proper computer animation like Pixar animation is exactly how you do animals talking and singing. You do not try to bring human faces and emotions to them in a realistic manner, because Lion King and Cats, which we will talk about, like has just proven that there's no, even when you bring like the best directors and the all the studio money to it, you just can't do it. It's the uncanny valley and you can't get out of it. Thank you for using my own joke against me.
Invent uncanny valley.
I did.
I've seen that.
Everywhere. I can go back into our Facebook Messenger chat. As soon as the Cats trailer got released, I said, we have now entered the uncanny valley.
All right, let me just have a look.
I'm sure a bunch of other people
tweeted
said
it
at the same
time.
I
may have deleted my tweet, though, because it got no likes.
Coward.
Oh, no, you said...
pause, ladies and gentlemen, while said, Richard reads...
I love I sent a link to the trailer, and you said, I love how much I hate this. It's exactly as fucking Bizarro Land, Uncanny Valley, as I hoped it would be. And then AJ said, this is a gift. I said, a Christmas gift. And you said, by the way, I'm trademarking Uncanny Valley now.
Yeah, so stick that in your fucking mouth.
And then AJ, you said, how about the Unfeliny Valley?
Yeah, so I'll let you have
just
Unfeliny
read
Valley. That's the one you coined.
That's so funny.
Man, a lot of people owe you money there,
receipts.
Jeremy, because I've seen that joke
receipts.
Everywhere.
Sweet. So, yeah, I think that's all we have to say about Lion King. Yeah. Okay, because so next up was another one that was on my most anticipated movie of the year, which The Lion King was on as well, is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Is this the only movie that we saw together as a three?
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
It's the only movie all three of us have seen together.
Yeah, wow.
Like, ever.
So we don't need to talk about
it,
because we all know
Rich
what we
and I have also gone to see a movie together.
Yeah.
AJ?
No, but the three of us,
yes.
I'm saying.
Yeah. So we don't need to talk about it, because we've already spoken about it.
The most exciting thing about this film is that Lord was sitting in front of us.
Remember
that?
And AJ was like, I want to do something.
She left before the post-credit scene, and I thought about tweeting her and being like, hey, Lord, you missed the post-credit scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But I was like, that's too creepy.
You're like, wait, I'm a white guy. That's creepy.
Why'd you have to make it a race thing? Okay, so What do we think of this film?
I'm going to put my hand up and say this makes a play for an early play for my most disappointing film of the year.
Yeah, I made a claim on the anticipated podcast that if this isn't my favorite Tarantino movie and my favorite Leo movie, I'm going to be disappointed by it because I had such high expectations.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's an interesting one because a lot of people were like, yeah, I think the general consensus is it wasn't as good as it should have been.
But then you have some people who are just like, this is the best film of the year.
Yeah,
I
some people fucking love it.
Yeah, so
much.
Some people think it's the best film of the year.
And the thing is, I've asked a few people when they've written this in like the Facebook comments under some of your posts and stuff like that. Like, I genuinely want to know what it is about this movie that you found so... Because for me, my biggest response to this movie, I was so bored. I was so just sitting there being like, what is happening and why are any of these people doing, and why did Quentin Tarantino choose to show us these characters doing these particular things for 3 hours leading up to what is actually a very exciting last 10 minutes? And like, it's a sweet relief, and it's almost like the sort of, you know, wonderful release after sort of just this agony of the previous 2 hours.
So I think you and I represent two different ends of the spectrum of how we feel the same way about this movie. I was like, yes, Daddy Tarantino, give me 3 hours of just people talking. I love a good like hangout movie. You've got just like these actors, and like every single role in this film was filled by a spectacular actor, except absolutely. For Zoe Bell.
Yes!
Who's
Zoe, please stop casting me in Tarantino movies, Bell.
And then you have this world killing, silly, stupid last 10-15 minutes. I like, because it's a Tarantino movie, everyone's expecting this big gore and gunfire at some point. And I was like, it had gone the whole movie without anything like that. And I was like, I would love if this was just it, you know? Like, it's real restraint. It's subverting audience expectations. But no, we just got this, like, silly kind of battle. And I think maybe it's because I'm not super knowledgeable about the whole Manson family and the whole case and everything like that. Whereas I think something like Inglourious Basterds, you see Hitler get gunned down in a movie theater, you're like, yeah, fuck you, Hitler. Mm. Whereas in this, there isn't that same sort of sense of satisfaction if you don't know, because all the people that get beaten up at the end are real people, and I've seen people say like, if you know the case. Like, that bitch that gets, the dog food to the face.
Yeah.
Fuck her, you know? And so it felt gratuitous, but it wasn't I didn't get the same sense of satisfaction because it's relying on your real-world knowledge, not what the film has done up until now, to be satisfied by that.
Yeah, it's like, the thing that really struck me about the movie, thinking about it afterwards, was that, like, it was really Tarantino being like, this... in some ways was this wonderful golden age of Hollywood, and the Manson murders really was this marking of a time where it all got ruined. And so it was almost his way of saying like, oh, fuck you for ruining this. I want a history where like things were able to continue the way that they were.
Yeah.
And so that's why it was so viciously sort of like, you know, in the face of these three people who did that. And I get that, but at the same time, like, there's just whole conversations in this movie that I'm just like, they feel completely untethered to anything. There's no motivations for any of these characters. There's no real plot. There's no, like, and I get, I like, I, when you say hangout movie, can you give me another example of a really good hangout movie where there's like a similar level of just kind of like
Dazed and Confused?
Oh, yes, I didn't like that either.
or like the Before trilogy.
Yeah, there,
like
there's some really successful moments in this. I loved the whole sequence with Brad Pitt arriving at the ranch and like the tension that Tarantino was able to build up. And like, I was like, this is masterful.
Oh, that's
work.
When he goes to see Bruce
the old
Dern.
Man.
Yeah,
and he
that's
like,
the best scene.
Like that's absolutely amazing. Like and you go, yeah, Tarantino is a master of his genre. Like when he chooses a genre. But there's just so many extraneous bits, and I was just like, I just don't care about any of this, and so it kind of failed for me as a film.
Yeah.
I have no idea what to make of this movie. Like that's what you said to me as the credits rolled, Rich, and I was like, I'm so glad you said that. If we'd come out of this theater,
I was so relieved when the two of you felt similar. I was like, oh, thank God, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, yeah, that was what it felt like. I was like, if Richard loves this, I actually don't know how to like jam with him about
like
it.
Like a real
Emperor's
New
no idea
Clothes kind of situation.
And I think I felt when I first saw Pulp Fiction, I remember I was like, I don't feel like that movie didn't do anything to me. And then very quickly I realized like what it's saying thematically and how each scene plays into that central theme. And now I love Pulp Fiction so much. I never understood in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood thematically what was going on. And Tarantino is so like, it feels aimless because of that. It feels like you're not watching things build towards a central idea or message or whatever. And so it just feels aimless, you know? And I think it might have been you, Jeremy. Afterwards, I was reading or heard somewhere that his message is actually quite... it's all about how, like, we need... This is a day and age we're living in now where the macho man has been relegated to the sideline because we don't believe in that anymore. And those
and
aren't
now
values we
men
have.
Are supposed to be in touch with their feelings like dirty hippies.
Yeah. And how this movie is kind of a testament to why we still need the macho man.
Like we don't like people like Brad Pitt, but when shit goes down and a beautiful woman like Sharon Tate's about to be murdered, we're really glad that like brutes like Brad Pitt are actually around.
Yep.
And they have their own code of ethics, which they have like sort of hardwired into them, and they're not going to let anyone else tell them what they should do.
Yeah.
And if that's the message of the film, I fucking hate that message. I think that's an awful message. And it makes me disagree fundamentally with what the film is saying, if that's what it's saying.
By the way, that's a message that I read a piece where someone's arguing that.
Yeah,
I wasn't right. I didn't come up with that myself.
I do think this has a chance to do very well at the Oscars, though, because its primary
audience is the Oscar voting
its main opponents are a South Korean film and two films from Netflix. And so I don't know if the Academy is ready to award things to a foreign film or Netflix yet, as we saw last year when Green Book won over Roma. And this is a period piece. It's about Hollywood. It's by a beloved director who's never won Best Picture
and
or Best Director
before.
And it's
got like some bona fide movie stars in it. Like,
yeah.
You can't get more glittering than them.
This is this year's Green Book, where it's if the Academy is not willing to take a risk and actually award the best film, this is their safe choice, their very in-character choice.
Well, and also correct me if I'm wrong, Tarantino's never won best film, right?
Yeah, no, he hasn't.
And so
he's never won best director either.
Yeah, and so they can, this is one of those times where they could absolutely be like, oh, he deserves it. We'll give
yeah,
an award
to
this
film. It's like a
legacy
one. Because this is their second or last chance to give it to him as well.
Yeah, true.
Allegedly. Yeah. It's crazy to think that Tarantino is this year's Green Book, but I agree. I don't think I like this movie now that I'm talking about it openly. Do you know what the biggest indictment I can give on this movie? I haven't thought about it since we saw it.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't thought about it once.
I do think, as someone who's known to be critical of Leonardo DiCaprio, I thought he was great in this movie. I thought he played the... So was Brad Pitt. Like, all the performances in this film are fantastic. Mm. Like, Brad Pitt plays that macho, lovable kind of guy that you just want to hang out with, essentially. And I thought Leo, he was able to sort of have a bit of fun with it, but also there's a lot of depth to his character and regret and also like that insecurity. And I saw an interview which summed up the, sort of my feelings about Leonardo DiCaprio when the interview, I think it was the first question they asked, because it was a round table with Tarantino, Margot Robbie, Brad Pitt, and Leonardo DiCaprio. And the first question with the interviewer was like, so you're playing an actor who's not very sure of their abilities. Was that a stretch for you? And like Tarantino, Pitt, and Robbie all like crack up. And then Brad Pitt's like, that is an amazing question. That is so funny. And Leo's just like, yeah, well, I mean, I think as actors, we've all got these these insecurities. And it's like, just laugh at the question or like play along. And it's like, Yeah, him on the campaign trail when you've got Margot Robbie and Brad Pitt, who are both so charismatic and so lovable, and then Leo is just like, oh, yeah, yeah, nah, that was a good movie.
Wait, my latest girlfriend just turned 25. I'll be back soon.
I have to kick her out of the house.
What an amazing build upon that joke. That it's not that he has to go wish her happy birthday. It's that now she's too old. fun.
Yeah, but I thought his stutter, like, that was a really good character thing, and how it disappeared when he was acting and when he was most vulnerable. That was wasn't there.
The biggest thing, and I think the thing that sums up the movie for me, is the fact that I felt like Leonardo DiCaprio's character was the most interesting character in the film, and yet there's no real resolution to his story at all.
We kind of get the 2 years later, and he's got a career now.
It's about his internal life.
Yeah, we've been talking about this movie for quite a while, and I'm realizing how fucking long this podcast is going to be. But just quickly before we move on, what do you guys think of the all the complaints there was about Margot Robbie not having enough lines?
I just think complaining about what a director chooses to do in a movie, when it comes to the characters that he himself has written, and when an actress signs on to be a part of that movie and loves the role and loves performing it and stuff like that, like, I'm getting a bit over people saying this director should have done this or this director should have done that, when it comes down to, like, if he had taken source material of a book or of something where Margot Robbie's character was a massive speaking role, and then he'd like minimized her right down to something, then yes, I think it would be a totally legit complaint. But the thing is, he conceived this movie to say something about Hollywood and keeping her as an icon and keeping her as sort of a vision of what Hollywood, of the perfection of what Hollywood could be. That's his choice to make, to say that she is a character. We're going to spend a lot of time with her, like a lot of time with her acting and on screen. If she's not saying a lot, that's an obvious choice of his. And I don't think it was a choice of his because he doesn't like women or he doesn't trust female characters. I think it's a choice about how he wants us to perceive her. And so for me, I didn't hold much stock.
Yeah, I think she was still a massive presence in the film. And like a lot of people said, she's the heartbeat of the film. And so, yeah, I don't think that she's relegated to a tiny role or anything like that.
The argument about Anna Paquin and The Irishman was similar, and I think Scorsese has more of a leg to stand on saying that character was the heart of the film. I barely remember Once Upon a Time in Hollywood enough to be able to comment on this with any real thought, but I will say this: I don't hold Tarantino. I think he's perfectly fallible, and it's perfectly possible that he has some unconscious biases towards women that he's not.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, but that being said, totally demonstrated in his other movies that he's made, which totally don't feature women in strong roles.
Yeah, exactly.
I was about to say exactly that, is that he has proven before this that he believes in women characters. So this probably isn't the best. I can imagine it being frustrating when you really want a character to represent something in a film and they happen to be a woman, and people act like you're relegating them to the sideline. I don't know. I don't know enough about
it. I also think that by fleshing out a real person who was tragically murdered too much, you're bordering on some iffy kind of territory.
I also just think that listening to what her sister said about the film, that erases for me the criticism, because her sister said it was like spending 3 hours with her sister and she couldn't have been happier. And I'm like, that's great.
Okay, so up next, a film that AJ and I have already talked about, so we'll just kind of quickly get your thoughts, Jeremy, but Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah, I mean, it was a Fast and Furious movie, so it was great. I really enjoyed it. Yeah. I think that all the other members of the Fast and Furious franchise would have been watching that movie being absolutely furious about how much fun it was. I think that the finale in Samoa was overlong, and it was a bit patchy, but
yeah,
I really enjoyed it. It was funny. It was full of action. It was exactly what you want out of those movies, and good on them. Make some more.
Yeah, I was on a plane a couple of weeks ago.
And was Kevin Hart sitting in front of you?
Yeah. And but yeah, someone like in front of me on the other side of the aisle was watching this film, and I was like, man, this is stupid. Like, at the time, I was like, oh yeah, cool. Like, I got into it, and I had a good time, but I was like, man, what a dumb film.
And just like all the like this is one place where Jeremyisms just don't belong. Like, Fast and Furious, like, I just don't give a shit.
This and About Time.
There are so many of them. Like, how much travel time is involved between London and Russia and then Russia to Samoa? And, like, sure. She's got this 36-hour window and you're like, oh, my God.
It's ridiculous. And I think the main thing that I'm, like, disappointed in this film is that The Rock and Jason Statham aren't going to be in Fast and Furious 9, because they're like the best parts of the film, that now we're getting a Fast and Furious 9 that's just Vin Diesel mumbling about family. Oh, and they're bringing back Jordana Brewster, which is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but you'll hear about that next week or the week after.
Yeah, for our complete thoughts on this movie and the franchise in general, go back and listen to our Fast and Furious episode.
Yeah, so the same day as Fast and Furious, we had The New Mutants. Hey, remember how that was supposed
finally.
To come out?
It's coming out this year. There's a trailer in April or something.
Yeah, there's a trailer that comes out on April 3rd, this 2020, and there's a trailer coming out the same day this is being released.
Is it going to be the same trailer as the previous three trailers that they've released?
Well, there's only been one trailer.
Oh, really?
And that came out 3 years ago.
Well, barely. Like, just over 2 years.
Can you imagine being a cast member? Because they're relatively young cast members, right?
Yeah.
Is it being a cast member of this film and being like, okay, we finally got the PR dates. This is your promo round. We're now going to get you to go and talk about the process of making this film from when you were 15.
It's insane. Yeah,
the director
this whole
has
process
said
is
that,
I've never seen this.
The film coming out is his original cut, which is interesting. But we'll talk about this more on Anticipated. Okay, so next up we've got Dora the Explorer. This I actually watched, the new live action Dora the Explorer. And you know what? It's pretty funny. It hits the right tone. There's a scene where they get high and...
What?
Classic Dora the Explorer.
It turns to like the cartoon world.
Oh my
gosh. It's very funny.
That's great.
It's It's how us three would write a Dora the Explorer movie kind of thing.
Oh, cool.
It's like if Nickelodeon came to you and said you have to write a Dora the Explorer movie, and it still has to be able to play on Nickelodeon, and it still has to like appeal to our audience, this is how you would do it.
Understood.
Artemis Fowl has been bumped to May next year, which another movie that I feel like has been coming out for fucking ever. Angry Birds Movie 2, another movie I watched. Not as good as the first one, but... it's still probably a lot better than you'd expect from an Angry Birds movie. Playmobil, the movie.
Which movie you were going to fly up here so we could watch together.
That's right.
Playmobil?
Yeah.
Playmobil, you promised.
Didn't that have like the worst opening of all time or something?
Yeah, it did.
That's hilarious. That Playmobil, the movie, is just something you look at and you're like, Hollywood, how did you not see what was going to happen?
Like, 3 year olds do not receive marketing for movies.
Okay, so Angels Fallen, the thrilling conclusion to that trilogy that no one gives a shit about, came out this year as well. Remember that? But
the two movies about taking the White House that came out at the same time,
that was the worst.
The
one
with Channing Tatum definitely was the one that should have had a trilogy rather than the one with.
I heard that was like a new Die Hard.
Gerard Butler.
And it was the new Home Alone. Anyway, we've got next big release. This is on my most anticipated of the year, and I think AJ, you might have had it as well. Is it Chapter 2? Now, AJ, I think you probably have a lot more to say about this film than I do.
Okay.
So why don't you kick us off?
I thought this was very disappointing. And when I first saw it ended and I was like, oh, that was all right. I didn't like it. But then as time has gone on, I'm like, I think I hated it.
Yeah.
Or at least I only remember bad things about it. I think like the casting, obvious, everyone always raved about the casting, and it is great, and Bill Hader is great. And a lot of people like this movie, a lot of people don't. I think it was real bad, and I think that there's like the whole second act is so stupid and convoluted, and it's like literally just fetch quests,
and it's just a reason to have the young cast in it.
Yeah, a reason to have the young cast back in it, and kind of a confusing place of like, where is the set? Like, I found it difficult to. It's not immediately obvious when they go to the flashbacks where the cast actually are. I think ultimately, as lovable as the young cast members were in the first one, I think it was a mistake to make the movie. A equal parts young and old. I think I think these should have been the movie where they're kids and the movie where they're adults. I don't know if that would have saved it.
There's a scene at the start when they all come back together in Derry and they're just having dinner at the Chinese restaurant, and then crazy shit starts happening. And when that was going on, I turned to Jess and I was like, because this is like 15 minutes of the film, I turned to Jess and I was like, I bet this is going to be the best scene in the film.
Yeah, right.
Like, this will be the highlight.
And it
probably was. But having said that, I didn't dislike this film. I think a lot of people really didn't like it. A lot of people I work with were like, yeah, it's shit. I think it gave me, for my money, it gave me more of what I liked from the first one, which is what I wanted. But I do think it's not, maybe not as competently made. It relies a lot more heavily on jump scares. I remember, because I'm not a big jump scare fan, and you saw this before I did, and you messaged me that you were like, oh, there's a bit where it's like when he looks under the bed, there's a jump scare, and you took note of it because you're like, oh, I'll tell Richard, because the first one didn't have any, and
so
I'll warn Richard about this one jump scare, and then there's like 50 of them. But
there is maybe one jump scare in It One.
Yeah.
There are like countless in It Chapter Two.
Yeah, but it is like a classic poorly done jump scare fashion where that's you can see it coming a mile away. It's oh, they're looking under something and the music rises and then something jumps out, you know?
I thought the ending was really weak as well. The way they defeat Pennywise is I don't understand why. Like, first of all, the way they defeat him in It Chapter 1 is great. The way they defeat him in It Chapter 2 is not only not as, like, impactful, but I don't know why you would assume that would keep him at bay if the one from the first one didn't keep him at bay.
Yeah.
Like, it's not higher stakes enough for you to be like, oh, now they've got him for good.
Yeah, because they're roasting him.
Yeah, they roast him to death. And it's like, well, you could have done that in the first one.
Oh, right.
Like, they just decide not to be scared of him, which is essentially what they did in the first one, but better. Yeah. I think that this is a concept that works far better with kids as the protagonists.
Yeah, for sure.
And I really thought this was... it's strange how bad this ended up being, I thought.
Yeah.
I didn't think it would be as bad as it was.
That's interesting. All right, so the Downton Abbey movie came out. Did you end up watching that, Jeremy?
I did end up watching it with my wife.
Did you like it?
She loved it, yeah.
Did you like it, Jeremy?
It's because I had watched the first three seasons of Downton Abbey.
How many seasons are there?
Six, I think. I quit watching it after Matthew died because I was like, yeah, this was obviously not in the original intentions of the series maker. And so now the story is no longer interesting to me. Anyway, it was a perfectly serviceable, for people who like that sort of thing, that is the sort of thing which they like.
That's the perfect review.
Yeah. So the thing that's hilarious about it though, is that, the main, tension in the film is that all of the servants who work in Downton Abbey, like the King and Queen, are coming to Downton Abbey, and the thing that they are most upset about is that the King and Queen are bringing all of their own servants to Downton Abbey and they won't have a chance to serve the King and Queen themselves. They're like, no, don't give us a weekend off. We want to work in the bowels of this great house.
Yeah, I know a few millennials that could use this movie. Am I right?
I just looked up the critical reception because, no offense, Jeremy, but you're often a dissenter from critical reception. It's got like 85% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I imagine that's because no one who hasn't seen the show is seeing this.
Yeah, well, for people who like that sort of thing, that is the sort of thing that they like. So, you know, it was fine.
So fuck you, AJ.
Gladly.
All right.
You're like, please.
So Spies in Disguise has been bumped to January. I think it's out now. So catch the Will Smith Pigeon movie in cinemas now.
I was just listening to a review of this and they said it was way better than it had any right to be.
Interesting.
It's got a higher Rotten Tomatoes score than Star Wars Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah,
we'll get to.
Because basically they talk about the fact that it's got really good slapstick and the person I was listening to said that basically very few cartoon animation houses these days are into slapstick violence and this one goes all in, and so it's really good for kids.
When AJ and I went to see The Boss Baby, I said, what do you reckon the chances are that there'll be a shot of someone falling or getting hit or something like that, and the camera will will zoom in on their face and it will go into slow motion and they'll be like, and they'll do a funny face. And it happened.
Blue
it happens
sky
in
face.
Every film.
It's blue sky face.
Yeah. So next big release. This is a big one. I had it on my most anticipated list of the year, and it's Joker. What did we think? Did it make you want to shoot anyone?
Yep. Can I go first? I've tried to reconcile my feelings about this film.
All right, yeah, let the white male go first.
I don't know if you guys know this, but I'm quite passionate about a lot of the things this movie was criticized for being against. And so learning that it was potentially quite a damaging movie, no pun intended, Jared Leto's Joker has damage on his forehead.
Nice,
When you have to explain your pun after saying no pun intended because it wasn't clear enough.
And then explain your explanation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Jeremy chime in.
The rest of this podcast is just us building on that.
So I went into this movie basically being like, I feel like this movie is going to offend me or be dangerous in different ways, yeah. Especially in a year which has seen so much fallout for what this movie was criticized for promoting. And I thought that, and I feel like that clouded any kind of critical judgment I could have of this film. I liked parts of it, and I thought the ending was pretty cool, and I thought that some of it was as cringy as everyone was joking it would be. Like, there's a part where he sees a sign that says "Don't forget to smile," and he crosses out "forget to," so it just says "Don't smile." And when that happened, me and my friends in the theater were like, "Holy shit! Oh my god, that's mind blowing," which was really funny. And so it's got a lot of stuff like that in it, which is cringy. And people, and like, I hate what what's the director, Todd Phillips, said about how, like, you can't make a comedy in today's woke age. And it was like the most setting himself
but he
up.
Said, and he said all the best guys have stopped doing comedy. And it's like, that's a great use of the word guys there, Todd.
Hey, guys.
And I don't know what I think of this movie because I was too concerned with being on the right being side woke. Of history with my reception to it. But I will say this, nothing... Like, there were no school shootings inspired by it, at least not yet. And
give it time.
So maybe a lot of that was for nothing. I don't think it's anywhere near the, like, mind-blowing game changer that... what was the festival that it premiered at?
Toronto?
Yeah. The one in France.
Cannes.
Yeah, yeah. That they said it was. I think... I would have been interested to see what I thought, being able to watch it without knowing that people had these like fundamental issues with what it was saying. And I don't know what that says about me as a film goer, but ultimately I kind of nothing this movie. And
I think it's undeniably a very well crafted, very well acted film.
Joaquin Phoenix is just a real fucking good actor. So no matter what you do with him, it's going to be
And
amazing.
I think it's, I think it's a super interesting character piece. I think it's so much better than anything Tom Phillips has done.
Yeah.
This is, you know, in my top 15, but not my top 10 kind of thing. Just before I forget as well, I was just reading the other day that apparently the original ending of this film had, you know, when all the riots going on and stuff like that, it would have the Joker go into an alleyway and kill Thomas and Martha Wayne and then, you know, do his laugh and then kill Bruce Wayne, little kid Bruce Wayne. Which would be an interesting twist on.
I always thought that was what was going to happen. I was like, this movie will end with Bruce Wayne dying.
Yeah, but it was. I thought it was great. I thought. I don't know. It's like, it's maybe not as good as some people are claiming it to be. It's not, but then it's also like, it's nowhere near as bad or. Yeah, it's not as bad as I think some people want it to be. And what you're saying about the school shootings and stuff like that, I thought it was kind of disgusting the way. The media beforehand seemed to really want this to inspire some shootings.
Yeah.
They're
almost daring someone to do it.
Yeah, it was so.
If you do it, we will cover you like nothing else.
Yeah. And that was gross. And then, Todd Phillips and the whole lead up to the film coming out, and his whole press tour was just fucking moronic.
Yeah. I think I saw this film well after it left cinemas, and so I had the whole cycle of commentary had gone totally gone, and so I came to it kind of expecting, you know, to be concerned, but also I'd read the things that people were like, oh, it's really not that bad. You know, I'd heard everything that you guys had to say about it as well. And so I had the reverse experience from you, AJ, where I felt like I could actually just not bring any of that into the watch of it and just see what it felt like. Mm. And what I found in the movie was actually a story that invited me to empathize. And I think that that's kind of the gross thing about a lot of the sort of commentary, the quote-unquote woke commentary about, like, oh, you know, the last thing we need to do is empathize, and a movie telling us to empathize with kind of like hateful right-wing like white guys who might shoot someone. But it's like, actually, if you want less of these people in society, this movie is showing you the conditions. And like, I thought about kind of the
less of these people in where, sorry, Jeremy?
Oh, shut up. But like...
Now, what was the word you used?
Yeah,
was
okay. Was it good on you. Anyway, so I thought about the fact that if this movie was like, if the ethnicities were changed to anything other than a white guy, this movie would be groundbreaking and amazing. And because basically it's going, where do the roots of violence come from? Where do the roots of disaffiliation, isolation, and disaffection come from? And I think that if we're looking at a group of people who are a concern to society, so like basically people with mental illness, like, you know, sort of loner white guys who have a predilection for violence and a feeling that they don't have any connection to society or that society owes them something. Actually, a film that explores what brings that mentality to the surface in people is really really timely. And
I think there's a massive school of people that think we don't want to hear those stories, though, because...
But that's the fact that people don't want to hear those stories is why this is, it's for me, I was kind of like, this is why, because I know people who are difficult to be around. I know people who, when you're around them and you're talking to them, they make you feel uncomfortable. And so the easiest thing is to just not be around them, to ignore them. Just like Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, you know, just like this character of Arthur, who is just like, oh, you're really awkward and you don't know the right thing to say. And like from the beginning of the movie, you kind of go, It's a tragedy. It's a Shakespearean tragedy.
I used to
tragedy.
Think it was a comedy, but now it's a tragedy.
It's a Shakespearean tragedy showing kind of like that. Yeah, I think it said something. For me, I saw something deeper about people. It wasn't about society. It was about people.
Yeah. But I think as well that like whether you're for or against this movie and this kind of movie existing, I think both sides have really interesting conversations to be had.
Which is why this movie caused so much conversation. Because, and I think that makes it a piece of art.
Yeah, and I think this has a chance at the Oscars. I think it probably will be nominated for Best Picture. I think Joaquin Phoenix will be nominated for Best Actor.
Todd Phillips just doesn't fucking deserve all these conversations, though.
Imagine that dude's a fucking idiot, Joaquin man. Joaquin Phoenix is the guy who wins the Oscar for The Joker.
Hmm.
What, like, oh, yeah, man. Yeah. No, he did win Best Supporting Actor. Yeah. Heath Ledger did. He won posthumous. Yeah. But like, crazy that the character of Joker inspires like performances that, you know, conceivably two performances in just over 10 years that win Oscars.
Yeah.
That could win Oscars.
And I mean, because who's played the Joker on live action film? Jack Nicholson, Heath Ledger, Jared Leto.
Oh, just all
Joaquin Phoenix.
Incredible.
All, Joaquin Phoenix is the only non Oscar winner.
That's true. Yeah.
So maybe he'll get one for this. So, okay, next up, The Addams Family, none of us saw it. Zombieland 2, this is a really interesting one, Zombieland Double Tap. I fucking do not remember this film. I saw it, and then like a week later, I was like, oh, because I had a friend up from Christchurch, and they was like, oh, what do we do with him? Because I was like, oh yeah, what do we do? And they was like, that's right, we went to Zombieland 2. And I was like, I guess I remember the plot. But like, and it was fine. It was probably better than a 10-year late comedy sequel.
That's my take on it. Is that the trailers for this movie were fucking awful.
Yeah,
they made it look like it was so like, you've seen this before. Remember these kinds of movies? These 10 years too late sequels to movies that didn't need one in the first place? Remember this? This is gonna fucking suck. It looked like pandering to you know, the whatever fan base the first Zombieland movie had. And it just looks like such garbage. And then I went to it, and because it was probably about as good as Zombieland 1, I felt like I had to sing its praises a little stronger.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, it's as good as this other 3.5-star movie.
Yeah, yeah. And what you've got to remember with Zombieland Double Tap is Zombieland isn't actually that great of a movie.
It's pretty good.
It's fine, you know.
It's fun.
I do think the strangest thing about this, and I think if I could be bothered watching it again, I would want to do like a video about this or something, is that this was, so if you, Jeremy, do you know much about the history of Zombieland as a intellectual property?
No, educate me, please.
So it was conceived as a TV show, and if you watch that, the original Zombieland, with that in mind, you start seeing things like Zombie Kill of the Week make a lot more sense if it was a TV show. And this like road trip kind of story makes a lot more sense if it's a TV show. And having like a different celebrity guest star each episode, like Bill Murray, would makes a lot more sense in a TV show, you know, things like that.
It would be an exciting, exciting weekly watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like a comedic answer to The Walking Dead, basically. They actually, a few years after Zombieland came out, Amazon did like their pilot season where they commissioned a bunch of pilots and people voted on which ones they'd want to see. And they made a pilot for a Zombieland TV show, which was a sequel to the movie where they'd recast everyone, which was its first mistake. And, you know, if I hadn't seen Woody Harrelson play Tallahassee, I probably wouldn't have known I was missing out on much seeing some guy I've never heard of play Tallahassee. And it kind of bombed and it didn't get bought for series. But then Zombieland 2 comes out 10 years later, and this movie was the end of the first season of a TV show written 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, everything about it is so, like, first of all, in kind of one of its most telling ways, like, a lot of the characters are real dated. There's like a stereotypical blonde, you know, dumb blonde new character in it whose entire purpose in the story feels kind like bordering on troubling in 2019, you know, whereas 10 years ago wouldn't have batted a fucking eye at this character. Yeah, this is
to be fair,
standard.
She's like the best part of the film though. She is very funny.
Yeah, she is funny. And
like the fact that they managed to get a lot of pretty good comedy out of like that, such a dated stereotype that you haven't seen the film for 10 years.
And it has been updated, but that's also really weirdly like anti-hippies and pro-guns in a way that, you know,
feels very once upon a time in Hollywood.
Yeah. Mainstream society really isn't that anti-hippies and pro-guns anymore. But, you know, 10 years ago when Zombieland 1 came out, maybe it would have felt a bit better. And it's the whole like climax of the film and everything about it feels like the end, like you're watching a whole season arc play out. And whether it's a whole second season, if the first Zombieland was the first season or not, like it just screams second season of a TV show that was all right, but not as groundbreaking as the first. So that's my
nice, very good. Love your little summations, AJ.
Thanks, man.
So now, next up, a few films that I don't think any of us saw or cared about. Are You Afraid of the Dark? Don't even think that came out here. Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood isn't out here yet, but I'm very excited to see that. Terminator 6, Dark Fate.
The biggest movie none of us saw, right?
Yeah, surely. This is this year's Planet of the Apes film.
Yeah.
Which I've never seen one of those in the cinema, but I love them. Sonic the Hedgehog was supposed to come out, but there was a big fiasco around that, wasn't there?
Yeah.
We should talk about that next year. And Charlie's Angels. Did you see that, Jeremy?
No, no one saw it.
Yeah, no one saw that. And Elizabeth Banks was not too happy about the fact that no one saw that.
I do feel like the studio did Elizabeth Banks dirty on that one, because man, did I not see very much. I did not see very much promo around that.
Yeah, there was that one song that Lana Del Rey.
I don't even know if it was supposed to be any good or not.
It's definitely not thought to be good by pretty much anyone other than Elizabeth Banks.
Yeah, who then, you know, came out and said that it's because of sexism that it bombed.
Which is it's such a bullshit reason. Like,
I disagree. I think that definitely could be part of it.
No, I like there are many film reviewers that like very positively review a whole bunch. Like film reviewers that I've listened to who very positively reviewed even like Ghostbusters 2016.
It's 51% on Rotten Tomatoes for the record.
Like actually said, I'm sorry, but like Charlie's Angels, this version of it, like I hated the previous versions because I thought it was like exploitative of women and all that sort of stuff. But obviously they had their place because they were successful. This one just tries to be all things to all people and it fails. And so it's like people I trust not to be sexist in terms of like their reviewing and yeah, like they.
But
just
also the fact that,
that
maybe you said that you didn't see any promotion for it, that could be.
Oh no, exactly. But the thing is that the studio, like, if you have a terrible movie on your hands, you're like, well, we're not going to spend a lot of money marketing it.
Mm.
I also just don't think anyone was crying out for a Charlie's Angels movie. Like no one was going, oh man, you know what we'd love.
Yeah, I think it feels a bit like a failed passion project, which I think we've got another one coming up.
Charlie's Angels is like that, eh? Because it had a TV show reboot about 10 years ago that no one watched either. And it's like they keep trying to bring it back up, but
yeah, it's one of those things where people that are in charge of things are now getting to the age where they grew up with the original.
Original was in the 70s.
Yeah, true.
So like, I mean, we're now two generations, like a whole generation beyond that.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. But you know, like there is this crowd of people that loved the original, and from what I understand of all the reboots and remakes, that they don't understand why it did so well. Maybe. And also, so they keep trying to update it for a new audience and they're missing something.
Also, entertainment speaks to culture, right? And so the best reboots are the ones that manage to take an existing property and find ways to connect that same, like the core of what it was, to the culture where it is now. And so I think the 70s and the late 90s had a very similar cultural moment. Which is why you got things like Mission Impossible being rebooted. And also you had all the people who were kids when they were all now adults of a certain age, and they loved seeing it. And so I just think Charlie's Angels time is over.
Right. Yeah. No more Charlie's Angels. Okay.
You heard it here first, folks.
All right. So there's also, we were supposed to have Kingsman the Great Game, which has now been renamed The King's Man, and that comes out late next year. This year, sorry. And I fucking love that title, The King's Man. I think that's such
a great
title.
Spoilers for the most anticipated podcast.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You can't give you can't give your thoughts on what's going to be coming up.
Right.
Okay, that was the end of the episode of part 3. Tune in next week for part 4, which is the second half of this discussion. It was a lot of fun and I hope you enjoyed it. If you are interested, we have our Letterboxd rankings of 2019 in the show notes below, as well as links to all the wonderful places where you can support Culpopshire, such as Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter. You can email us at culpopshiremedia@gmail.com. You can leave a 5-star review on iTunes. You can listen to us on Acast. Do all these things, please. We are desperate for your attention and your love and support. And so, yeah, do all those things and tune in next week. And also, don't stop listening just yet, because we have a new segment that on the show from our Patreon supporters, of course, being the post-credit scene. And that should be coming up just a few seconds after I finish talking right now.
Hey everybody, thanks for listening to this episode and thanks for sticking around here at the end. We've got a little bit of a cheeky new thing we're doing in 2020, just for you sneaky little boys and girls who have listened this far.
And who donate on Patreon.
Yeah.
That's,
everyone
that's
can
mainly
hear this,
who
right?
this is for. Yeah, absolutely. But you can only be featured if you're part of our Patreon. So this is our post-credit sequence, our first one for 2020.
Part of a new tier. of Patreon.
Yeah, well, not an, it's part of an old tier, but a new addition to an old tier on Patreon. And if you want to be included in this, you can go to www.patreon.com/coldpopshire and throw in some change. And you can also do the following, which is, we said, I think it's the $5 tier, donate to the $5 tier, and you can ask us a question, give us a challenge, that's something to talk about in this little section after each episode for me and Richard. And Richard, this first question, the first ever post-credits scene, comes to us from Michael Griffin, and he asks, what is your most anticipated console game of 2020, or discuss why Justin Theroux should play AJ in the biopic about Colt Popshire?
All right, which one do you want to do?
Well, we can
do...
And
we dare not answer the other question that we don't think.
We can answer both. Okay, more, my most anticipated video game of 2020 is, without a doubt, The Last of Us Part 2. I love The Last of Us and The Last of Us Left Behind so fucking much. They are like my favorite pieces of media in existence. They mean so much to me, and I am so excited for the belated sequel to Let Me Down.
I guess I have the same answer. Like, I don't know, I'm not a huge gamer boy. I know you're quite a Rise Up Gamers kind of guy.
I'm a
big fan of the Joker.
Misogynist, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to Last of Us Part 2 very much. There's a lot of games that I'm like, oh yeah, I'm looking forward to that, but I probably will never get, like Cyberpunk 2077. I'm also, despite what people said when the footage was first released, I'm actually still looking forward to Marvel's Avengers game from Square Enix.
True, and I'm also looking forward to the new Oddworld game, I think, is coming out this year.
Oh, yeah.
Which is called Soulstorm, so I'll be excited about that. Though I do not think it will recapture the magic of the 1990-something original.
There's also the Star Wars Skywalker saga, Lego Star Wars Skywalker saga.
Oh, really?
Which is all 9 films. That'll be fun.
Nice. Okay, well, why should Justin Theroux play me in a biopic?
Because he's real hot.
Thanks, man. All right. Who should play you?
Who's hotter than Justin Theroux?
Tessa Thompson.
Yeah.
Can be Lady and the Tramp. Cool.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.